Today's presenting sponsor is SimpliSafe Home Security. April Fool's Day is all about pranks and surprises, but your family's security is no laughing matter. With SimpliSafe, there are no gimmicks like unbreakable contracts or hidden fees, just real protection you can count on 24/7, because the only surprises you should deal with are harmless ones. With SimpliSafe, millions of Americans enjoy the new standard in home security and greater peace of mind every time they arm their system when heading out in the morning or when locking up each night. Traditional security systems only take action after someone has already broken in. That's too late, obviously. SimpliSafe's Active Guard outdoor protection can help prevent break-ins before they happen. If someone's lurking around or acting suspiciously, those agents see and talk to them in real time, activate spotlights, and even contact the police, all before they have the chance to get inside your home. No long-term contracts or cancellation fees. Monitoring plans start affordably at around $1 a day, 60-day satisfaction guarantee, or your money back. And you can set it up yourself. John Lovett did, and he loves it. Visit simplisafe.com/cricket to claim 50% off a new system with a professional monitoring plan and get your first month free. That's simplisafe.com/cricket. There's no safe like SimpliSafe. Welcome to Pod Save America. I'm Jon Favreau.
I'm John Lovett.
I'm Tommy Vietor.
On today's show, Trump says he's not joking about trying to serve a third term and that there are, quote, methods to get around the very clear constitutional amendment that prevents him from doing so. Of course, Trump's already acting like a dictator. The Supreme Court will decide whether he can round up people without due process and send them to a foreign gulag, which apparently ICE agents are now doing based on tattoos that they think might be suspicious. The first pair of elections that could give us a hint as to how voters are feeling about America's golden age are Tuesday. We'll talk about Elon's last-minute Wisconsin trip to quite literally buy people's votes. Then you'll hear my conversation with newly minted Senator Ruben Gallego of Arizona about how he's feeling about Trump's second term and what more Democrats can do to fight back. But first, by the time you're hearing this, we'll just be one day away from Liberation Day. Big day, guys. That's what Trump is calling Wednesday, April 2nd, the day he's expected to announce a set of reciprocal tariffs, which are tariffs on other countries that impose tariffs on us. But in remarks aboard Air Force One on Sunday, he indicated that he'll be going much bigger.
You're expecting to hit something like 10 to 15 countries, is that right?
No.
All countries?
All of the countries.
Is it across the board?
Not 10. I don't know. Who told you 10 or 15 countries?
That you were going to aim for the
10%. But you didn't hear it from me.
Okay, so how many countries will be in that initial tranche?
You'd start with all countries, so let's see what happens. We're going to be much more generous to them in terms of heart. We're going to be much more generous than they were to us. This country is going to be more successful than it ever was. It's going to boom. We're going to have boom down USA. We're going to boom.
We're going to boom.
It's going
to
boom, all right.
We're going to boom. So no one seems to know what Trump is actually going to do here, including his own advisors. There's been a bunch of reporting that he may just do blanket tariffs of up to 20% on all imported goods from everywhere, which is what he talked about during the campaign. Peter Navarro, Trump's trade guy, told Fox over the weekend that the tariffs will raise $6 trillion over 10 years.
Only?
Which experts say would be the largest tax hike in American history, although Peter Navarro calls them tax cuts.
Sure. Yeah, of course he does.
And when Kristen Welker at NBC asked Trump about the 25% auto tariffs that are scheduled to go into effect this week, he said he, quote, couldn't care less if car companies raised their prices. Couldn't care less was the quote. Sure enough, the S&P ended March with its steepest monthly decline since the Fed raised rates in December of 2022 and the worst quarter at the start of a president's term since the financial crisis in 2009. Not good moments, either of those.
Right.
What do you guys think? How's America's golden age looking right now?
So the only way I can make sense of what Trump is doing on with tariffs as a policy matter is it's got to be part of a negotiating strategy where he's just trying to convince these other countries that he's so crazy that he's going to tank the global economy so they come to the table and cut a deal. Because the stated rationale for all these tariffs are self-evidently ridiculous, like cutting off fentanyl flows from Canada, right? It just doesn't make any sense. And that's because tariffs are a tool. They're not a strategy. They're designed to protect existing industries against unfair trade practices by other countries like China dumping a bunch of steel or aluminum into the U.S. market. But they're not designed to grow a U.S. industry on its own like the CHIPS Act was, which Trump says he wants to get rid of. And so even like in the most charitable scenario where Trump tariffs the auto industry, so Mexico, it becomes more expensive to create, assemble vehicles in Mexico, so GM and Ford rev up some plants here, that's going to increase prices for everybody. And I know Trump doesn't care, but the companies can't eat that hit. So labor costs are much higher in the US than in Mexico, so it's going to raise prices for everyone. So just like none of it makes sense. You know, it's like tariffs, when used effectively, they're targeted. But we're talking about a broad-based 20 to 25% tariff on every country, maybe? And if China's the real threat and the real problem, why are we starting by tariffing the EU and Canada and Mexico and all the allies that we actually need?
Or all the countries, as he sort of hinted at.
Right. It's, they can't be reciprocal tariffs if it's tariffs on the whole world. The other fundamental problem is the more money your tariffs are raising, the less your tariffs are working to produce the result that you claim they're going to produce. If putting tariffs on the world leads to a boom, a manufacturing boom domestically, then the revenue coming from those tariffs should slowly tick down. If tariffs really are raising $600 billion a year consistently, it means we are still importing huge amounts of goods. The other part of this that's confusing is, on the one hand, you have Navarro out there saying this is going to raise vast sums of money, the greatest tax increase in history, which would be extremely disruptive to the economy. And then today you watch as the markets kind of flit around, but still are behaving as if this is sort of an idle threat. Like they're not, you know, we're not seeing the kind of like chaos in the markets you would expect. If we thought we were going to see the biggest tax increase in history and some of the most, some of the greatest disruption to trade that we've ever seen.
I mean, I think that the markets are pretty, the fact that we had the steepest decline since in a couple of years and in just 1 month of the first term, and it's like entirely self-inflicted. I think that obviously there's some uncertainty on what's actually going to happen here. Mm-hmm. But I think most of the economic indicators and most of the people, like everyone's raising their recession risks.
I'm not saying the signs are good. I'm not saying the signs are good, but like the Dow is still up year on year. The S&P is still up year on year. NASDAQ still up year on year. Like everybody is still behaving as though Trump is going to do these kind of chaotic tariffs. He turns off, turns on, he turns off. No one is behaving. The markets aren't behaving as if what we're about to see is like a fundamental shift in U.S. economic policy that's going to last.
I think what the markets think is that what will happen this time is what will happen last time, which is Trump will threaten this universal tariff and then he'll delay it. And then an army of lobbyists will storm into the White House and they'll carve out special deals for big companies like Apple or GM or whichever foreign leader buys enough Trump coin will get an exception. Half kidding there. And so I also think that these countries that like cut a deal with Trump, they know that Trump only cares about the day one headline. Like the Chinese in the first term said they were going to buy billions and billions of dollars of American exports. And Trump trumpeted that and took a huge win. And then they bought none. They bought zero additional exports. They just didn't care. So you can give Trump the win on the negotiation and then win for real in the implementation.
He also said over the weekend that someone's like, are you going to lift them at some point? If something happens, he's like, no, these are permanent now. I have been trying to envision a scenario where this trade war doesn't ultimately inflict real political damage on Trump and the Republicans. I am coming up short. I think that there have been certainly many times in the first term, and even at the beginning of this one, where he has gone forward, backed off, delayed, backed off. But like, I think that he believes that, and his advisors believe, some of his advisors at least, most of them, that they are sort of restoring economic nationalism to America. And they're going to remake, I saw somewhere that he thinks he's going to remake the global economy, not just for years or decades, but maybe centuries.
Centuries.
That's what they said this morning.
I love a century. I love a time horizon on Trump that's centuries.
And so I do feel like it's more of an ideological project, a crazy one, but an ideological project than I had originally assumed, just based on what Navarro's saying, what Trump's been saying, what Vance has been saying, and Bannon and all the big economic nationalists. I think it's fucking crazy, and I think they're going to find out like pretty quickly that it is very damaging. But I don't know what you guys think.
Yeah, I mean, there's another school of thought that some economists think that the Trump plan is to, long story short, like weaken the American dollar by cutting a bunch of deals with other countries and forcing them to stop currency manipulation to make it cheaper to export American goods and thus resuscitate American manufacturing. that too sounds a little far-fetched to me.
Yeah.
You also have, Politico was reporting this, that Republican House members, industry groups are scrambling right now for exemptions, like to the point Tommy made earlier, that they are desperately trying to exempt. You know, farmers are already being hit hard by the impact of tariffs, that there are tons of industries in Republican districts that they're, that these Congress people are worried are going to be adversely affected. Their industry groups desperately trying to figure out how to lobby. And so now, look, maybe they are doing some grand ideological realignment, but one way to make sure you are in control, able to do the kind of corruption you want to do, where companies and Republicans have to come and pledge fealty to you, is by being deadly serious right now, while so you can then claim you've put on these big tariffs while there's tons and tons of holes cut into them for which you've gotten God knows what concessions, promises, etc.
It is just worth quickly pointing out that there's no legal authority to do this. Trump is claiming he's going to do it, or some of his team is suggesting they're going to use a law called AIPA, which allows the president to regulate commerce in response to a national emergency overseas. So we're going to declare there's a national emergency in every single country, and therefore we're slapping a 20% tariff.
It is.
It's nonsensical.
The legal basis for many of his foreign policy decisions seems quite fragile.
Not there. There was a great story in the Journal about Harley Davidson and tariffs. Harley Davidson, great American company. They could face a 50% retaliatory tariff on selling Harleys abroad. So they did the math on a Harley Davidson sale in Denmark. It would go from $28,000 to purchase here in the United States to $124,000 all in with all the VAT tax and everything else over there. So it's just going to decimate Harley Davidson. And they dealt with this in the first Trump term. And in response, they actually moved some production from the US to Thailand. So there's like effects you cannot anticipate. They're not going to be good.
I was going to say, not only are prices going to go up and he doesn't care about that, but the stated goal of the tariffs to bring back production and manufacturing in the United States isn't going to work on a whole host of industries, because it's not the way that the world works anymore. It's cheaper to move stuff overseas.
And just even on its own terms, like look at cars, right? Navarro's out there saying it's going to generate $100 billion. Let's say there's 8 million cars imported that were sold, right? That's over $10,000 per car. There's not some immediate increase in the supply of American-made cars to make up for the more expensive cars that would be coming from abroad. The cost of all of these cars goes up. The cost of everything goes up.
And for the American car companies, the cost of the materials to make the car is going to go up because they rely on materials from overseas.
And these materials cross the border like 3, 4, 5 times. Are we going to tariff them every single time?
I've heard a lot of people make the argument that the Trump tax bill that we're going to be debating soon is going to be like when Bush tried to privatize Social Security in 2005. I actually think that Trump's tariffs could end up being the more apt comparison here, because he's just sending out a lot of signs that he doesn't really give a shit about the prices.
Overtly said as much.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And, there was this thing that like maybe the stock market, he cares so much about the stock market, and like that'll be, you know, I kind of bought into that too. It doesn't seem like that he cares about that either.
Yeah, but it's only been a 10% correction. I mean, like we haven't felt real pain in the stock market yet.
I think the thing he cares about more than that, right? Like if you watch Fox right now, they're like, Donald Trump's approval rating has never been higher because it touched like 49, right? And while his approval on the economy has gone down, his approval on immigration has never been higher. And you watch his immigration number. He is at the lowest he's ever been on economic approval since he's been president. His approval on handling inflation is going down. These are Fox polls. Like, those are numbers he does care about. And those are ticking down and down and down.
Yeah, the Fox poll said that 53% of people said that tariffs will hurt the economy versus help the economy at only 28%. 69% accurately say it'll make products more expensive. So it's not like people don't understand tariffs, right, or don't get what's going to happen here.
They're pretty sophisticated in these answers.
Very sophisticated. And the new AP poll in the economy does have them at 40-58 on the economy, and trade even lower at 38-60. And, you know, his approval is sitting at 42. There's also now talk about stagflation, which he was asked about, which is, you know, when you have both inflation and weak economic growth.
Seems bad.
And high unemployment. Yeah. Yeah. Ask Jimmy Carter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How that went for him.
Can't ask him anymore. But we could try. Yeah. I agree with you, though. I mean, I do think the big caveat is always like, if implemented as currently described, I think these tariffs would be disastrous. And we're already seeing polls where you have people saying Trump is too focused on tariffs. Only 23% of people think Trump's policies are making them feel better off financially in the CBS poll. And to the point on the stock market, like there's been a 10% correction so far, which basically means like the stock market has given up the gains it had from election day until now. But if these tariffs really go into place as described, that could lead to another 10%, 20%, 30%, like a serious hit to the stock market. And that's when all of his donors are going to be calling him and be like, what the fuck are you doing? This is not what we, you know, bought you for.
Yeah. And also, like, stock market aside, just if economic indicators outside the stock market keep getting worse, then it's just going to be bad for everyone and his popularity. Pod Save America is brought to you by Article. We get some Article furniture.
Sure do.
We've had it in the office for a while. I have some patio furniture at home.
Yeah, lots of
stuff. It looks great. It's really affordable. It arrives quickly. Article allows you to effortlessly create a long-lasting, stylish home at an unbeatable price. Their curated collection of mid-century modern, coastal, and Scandi-inspired pieces can stand alone or be combined with nearly any other Article product. This thoughtful design approach makes mixing and matching incredibly easy, helping you create a cohesive and stylish space. Article offers fast, affordable shipping across the U.S. and Canada with options for professional assembly if you prefer a hands-off experience. If you have a question or need help with your design choices, Article's customer care team is available 7 days a week, offering knowledgeable support and even free interior design services to help you get your home just right. With Article's 30-day satisfaction guarantee, you can shop with confidence, knowing that if you're not completely in love with your new furniture, you can easily return. Turn it. This peace of mind ensures you can invest in your home without hesitation. Article's offering our listeners $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more. To claim, visit article.com/crooked and the discount will be automatically applied at checkout. That's article.com/crooked for $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more.
Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step four, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Let's talk about the other news Trump made on Sunday that I referenced at the top of the show in his call with Kristen Welker, which sadly there is no audio of. Trump apparently said he was, quote, not joking about serving a potential third term. When asked why he wanted to do that, Trump said, quote, I like working.
Yeah.
He also talked about this in that press avail on the plane. Let's listen.
You said you were not joking about a third term, about possibly wanting a third term. Does that mean you're not planning to leave office on January
20th? I'm not looking at that, but I'll tell you, I have had more people ask me to have a third term, which is in a way a fourth term because the other election, the 2020 election, was totally rigged. I don't even want to talk about it. I'm just telling you, I have had more people say, please run again. They said, we have a long way to go before we even think about that.
Please, please, sir, run again. More tariffs and run again. Here's the 22nd Amendment, quote, no person shall be elected to the office of the president more than twice. Trump fans are pointing out that the amendment only refers to being, quote, elected and not serving. Welker also said she floated to Trump the idea, like, why did she do this? But she floated to Trump the idea of J.D. Vance running with Trump as his running mate, winning, and then passing the baton off to Trump, like a little Putin Medvedev.
Yeah, yeah, that's really cool. Let's definitely emulate that.
Trump said that that was one method. He acknowledged that was one method, quote, but there are others too, which he then refused to elaborate on. I should note here that the 12th Amendment states that, quote, no person constitutionally ineligible to the office of president shall be eligible to that of Vice President of the United States. So the whole swap thing doesn't seem like it would fly with the 12th Amendment
but
either.
It does fly with the 12th Amendment because he is eligible as long as he's not elected. If he's not, that he can become president. Like, there's
I think it's just you and Larry Tribe think that.
I just think we should assume.
Legal minds.
Yeah, look.
We've been down this road before, I believe.
Last time we were on the opposite side of the issue,
I remember.
I won in front of the Supreme Court. Larry Tribe, zero. Lovett, one.
Are we taking Trump seriously and literally on this one?
Absolutely. I think Trump is, first of all, I think he's having fun with this. He's enjoying this, right? You know, the idea that we're in a place where Trump is so resoundingly popular that the country is clamoring for yet another turn is of course ridiculous and exists only in his mind. For what it would take for Donald Trump to become president a third time is a kind of Medvedev as president, Putin as prime minister, an actual campaign in which Republicans are fully admitting that they are just vassals for a Trump dictatorship, or some other ridiculous scheme in which he is made Speaker of the House or some other cockamamie shit in which the whole Republican Party is now completely given over to the idea that Donald Trump is a dictator. But we don't really need to worry yet about the possibility that Trump is going to behave like a dictator 3 years from now, because he's behaving like a dictator right now.
Yeah.
We probably should focus on that. And our job is to make Trump so completely unpopular and unpalatable to the American people that this becomes a joke.
Yeah, we need him to have a Katrina-level approval ratings. Yeah, I think these things start as outrage bait. It's just like chum for media attention. It's chum to get MSNBC fired up. Like Steve Bannon being intimately involved in this, I think, is a real clue. But over time, I do think the outrage bait evolves into something real in a lot of cases, like Greenland, invading Greenland, for example.
Overturning the election.
Yeah. And once Democrats get really worked up about literally anything, negative polarization can take over. And Republicans in Congress, for example, decide that politically they would rather be opposed to what the annoying Democrats say than in favor of what the Constitution says. And so I do think there's like a real risk here, and it's part of a very rapid authoritarian slide. But I agree. Like, I just don't want to take the bait on it. I don't think we need to have members of Congress putting forward bills to focus on it. Like, focus on the here and now.
I was gonna say, those bills aren't going to go anywhere anyway.
Right.
I mean, just so people know, like, how this would work if it happened, right, is he would try to seek his party's nomination, right, which the party probably would just let happen, maybe. Let's say the Republican Party doesn't stop him there. He eventually would need to get his name on the ballots in all the different states. And certainly the blue states wouldn't put him on the ballot. So then it would go to the Supreme Court, and then we'd hear what the Supreme Court said. And then the Supreme Court would either be like, obviously, this is fucking crazy, you can't do it. Or they would do what sometimes they've done in the past and surprise us all and say, go for it, right? But if they tell him no, and then we're getting to the point where he clearly does not give a fuck about the judiciary, right? Mm-hmm. They are testing this out, as you said, like, we don't have to think about this 4 years from now. They're testing it out right now.
Yeah.
And they're testing it out with birthright citizenship, which they'll get a ruling on, right? Like, there's going to be a whole bunch of things like this. But yeah, I mean, I forget which one of you said it, but one scenario is he just doesn't leave office, which is basically the scenario he tried last time.
Yeah, we saw that one, yeah.
Yeah, so we don't have to think about a campaign or handing off to J.D. Vance. You could imagine a scenario where he either says, I'm not leaving office and I'm staying, or there's an election between J.D. Vance and some Democrat, and it's close enough, and it's like a 2020 situation, and he's like, oh, well, while we do a recount and while we fix this out, I'm just going to stay in power for a little while, mm-hmm. and then it just goes and goes and goes and goes. So yeah, I think everyone should, like, I don't think we should like laugh about it, right? But I do think we should be like, fuck you, you're not doing this. It's
yeah, know? I just think he would do it. He would love to do it. I think he would do a fucking make J.D. Vance his little puppet. That's a fun way there's a lot of methods. Look, if you don't believe in the Constitution, we should also say, like, it is a like, we're so used to this now. Saying this is disqualifying. It's despicable. The clear intent of the 22nd Amendment is that he should not be able to seek a third term. The language is not, like, the language leaves a loophole for him to seek the office in some ridiculous roundabout way. But there's lots of ways that if you just, if you don't believe in the Constitution, don't care about its precepts, there's all kinds of workarounds, including with the pardon power that he uses every fucking day lately. So this is like on the verge of an impeachable offense to claim you're going to kind of not leave office. But it's not our job to kind of, let's leave it at that.
Obama should run.
Yeah.
That'd be fun. We should mop the floor with this piece of shit.
So he would
great. Run it back, sir.
Right before we recorded, Trump was doing an avail in the Oval Office again for another one of fucking executive order. I don't know what it was. Kid Rock was there. He was asked about the Obama thing because Mike Lawler, a Republican from New York was asked about Trump running again on CNN. And instead of just saying, no, of course not, that's crazy, he was like, well, we wouldn't want Obama to run for a third term, would we? So that was, so then Trump was asked about it and he said, I'd love it. But I think if he's going to try to, you know, bait us and make us freak out and have some fun with it, we should have some fun with it every time we're at, like, number one, we should just say, yes, Obama's going to run and mop the floor with him. We should also, reporters should be asking J.D. Vance about this, because if I was J.D. Vance, I'd be pretty pissed.
Yeah.
Right? Like, there was a story today that J.D. Vance is doing his first fundraiser tonight by himself and he's getting this network of donors getting ready for 2028.
So cute.
Yeah, I would ask J.D. Vance. And even better, if J.D. Vance and Donald Trump are ever together and do a joint interview, I would ask them together so that J.D. Vance could be really sad when Donald Trump is like, oh, I don't know. I don't know if I'm going to do it. Like, there's so much we can do with this. There's got to be a little bit of, yes, we don't freak out, but we also don't say like, oh, we can't talk about it. Like, well, fuck them. No, you're not going to run again, you asshole.
Yeah, I think the mere act of asking him about it suggests we're taking it seriously, and their response will be like, chill out, libs. But yeah, I'm with you. Like,
no, like you
mock
said,
him back.
You chill out when Barack Obama is the nominee against him.
I do like thinking about the scenario where like J.D. Vance has just won and been elected president of the United States, and it's now like kind of the deal. The deal is that he's supposed to resign.
Right. Yeah. Good luck.
What are we talking about here?
He's like, no. My loyalty is to the guy that I once called Hitler. That's no. I'm sorry, sir. I gotta stay here and go be. Go take over Greenland.
Yeah, and presumably, unlike some of the reporting we've seen, unlike Biden, Trump believes his vice president's actually up for it.
Well. He was asked, is he the heir apparent? Remember, like a couple weeks ago, a month ago, and he was just like,
a lot of heirs. He could be, couldn't be.
So maybe more like Biden than we think. Yeah. So as we were saying, Trump's already in his dictator era. One sign of that is the administration is seeking to dictate which media outlets get to cover the president and how. On Sunday, Axios's Mike Allen wrote that the White House plans to hijack the White House briefing room seating chart from the White House Correspondents Association in the coming weeks. Back in February, of course, they took control of the press pool, another historical prerogative of the Correspondents Association. And separately, they barred the AP from the pool and from covering White House events, which the AP is now in court over. Seating chart. Big deal? Not a big deal? Tommy, what do you think?
Much like a wedding, it matters. It sounds silly. We're literally talking about where reporters sit in the White House briefing room, which sounds silly, but it matters for a couple of reasons, because the seating is supposed to reflect a pecking order in terms of which outlets get to ask questions and when. Traditionally, it has gone. The Associated Press, major TV networks, other wire services up in the front two rows, followed by big newspapers and so on. The press secretary gets to jump around, but like that's how it's supposed to go. So the most influential outlets that are the most serious traditionally get to ask the question. The Trump people want, like Marjorie Taylor Greene's boyfriend, whose name I can never remember. There's a bunch of them, I bet. They're
all Marjorie Taylor Greene's
boyfriend. Yeah, they want to stack the briefing room full of right-wing propaganda sycophants and make sure that more of the briefing room is eaten up by sycophantic questions. And that, like, lets them get off, you know, get out of the briefing without making a mistake, but also lets them own the media. And I do think, like, the things you mentioned at the top, the bigger picture is they just want to control the press. And when you combine this step with kicking the AP out of the pooled press rotation, which for folks who don't know, the press pool is the group of reporters who go with the president into smaller venues or rooms into the Oval Office, et cetera. And then the White House dictating which non-wire service news outlets rotate as part of the print pool. So instead of the Washington Post, you have some, you know, right-wing YouTuber shouting questions at Trump. Like, that really matters. It's a significant erosion of press freedom. And I will say at the same time, Trump is taking way more questions from the press than Biden did or past presidents have. So I don't want to sound hyperbolic here, but, you know, the press corps writ large is dealing with industry disruption and a collective action problem that we're seeing everywhere else. And they just do not know how to fight back. They're fighting back by like wearing a pin.
And they're doing it individually. And canceling Amber Ruffin.
Yeah, canceling the comedian at the Correspondents Center.
Yeah, fascism is rising. No jokes. But the one impact of this is, you know, we're used to, like, sometimes the questions are funny. There are famous, like, you know, reporters shouting questions like, what about your gaffes? But like when questions were shouted at the president, they would be substantive questions about, and now some of the questions coming from these
you're
people,
starting to hear,
they're like, how long have you been this handsome? What are we going to do to stop these liberals from stopping you from protecting our citizens?
Zelensky,
from
why aren't you wearing a suit?
Right, Zelensky, why aren't you wearing a suit? Like,
and you still get, at least at this stage, you're still getting some tough questions here and there, mm-hmm. but you can already tell that the balance between the softballs and the ridiculous ones and the tough questions is way off at this point.
And like the question, right, is like, who owns that briefing room? Like, who owns that space, right? And Trump wants to control it. He wants to own, like, it's what he's doing with Doge. It's what he's doing to colleges, what he's doing to law firms. He's exerting control. And it starts with seating charts and who fucking cares about seating charts? But it ultimately ends with, like, you know, you see, you know, AP is having to fight to get their way back in. You slowly but surely have fewer and fewer major outlets with access and with regular frequent ability to ask questions of the White House, of the press secretary, the president. And then now that briefing room is just another kind of another place controlled by Donald Trump.
I think What About Your Gas was a great question.
I agree.
Shout out Ashley Parker.
Next thing you know, we're going to have like NBC and CNN sitting in Greenland asking questions.
Well, yeah, just fully kicked out of the White House complex.
Did you guys see, by the way, did you catch J.D. Vance's speech in Greenland?
I saw the photo of him standing sadly in front of a group of people that have to be there because it's an order.
He had a little Zelensky outfit on, kind of.
Yeah, he did.
And that, but the creepiest thing that he said, because someone asked him a question like, "What are you doing? Saying that you're gonna take over Greenland? Like, what's going on?" And he goes, "We can't just ignore the president's desires."
It's real, real fascism. Real authoritarian.
Also just like creepy and weird. We can't ignore the president's desires. That's why we're in Greenland today talking about taking it over.
It's really strange, right? It's what he's saying, right, is that like, I am a representative of the president. This is the policy of the president. I'm not going to ignore that. But it's this the way in which it's all revolves around Donald Trump's psychology.
Also, the trip started as Usha Vance doing a bunch of cultural stops, and it evolved to J.D. Vance like bigfooting the trip, and then they never left the U.S. military base because everyone hates them.
Yeah, they couldn't find a person who wanted to talk to Usha Vance.
Did you see J.D. Vance with his tray, getting a meal with the service members there? And it just, you can just feel him having no place to sit at lunch in high school.
Sad.
You just see it in his face. I related to him.
Yeah.
I felt it.
I was just trying to make sure he listens to the president's desires. This podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform designed to elevate your online presence and drive your success. Squarespace provides all the tools you need to promote and get paid for your services in one platform. Create a professional website to showcase your offerings and attract clients. Whether you offer consultations, events, or other experiences, Squarespace can help you grow your business. Squarespace offers a complete library of professionally designed and award-winning website templates with options for every use and category. Every dream needs a domain. Squarespace domains make it easy to find the best name for your business at one fair, all-inclusive price. No hidden fees or add-ons required. Every Squarespace domain comes with advanced privacy and security tools included to ensure your domain remains online and protected. Plus, Squarespace provides everything you need to bring more of your dream to life, whether that means building a website or adding a professional email service. Don't wait to claim your name. Invest in your dream domain today. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/crooked to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/crooked.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
One more update on our budding dictatorship. After the D.C. Court of Appeals ruled that Trump can't just ship people to El Salvador's torture dungeon without due process. One of the judges actually said that, quote, Nazis got better treatment under the Alien Enemies Act. The administration asked the Supreme Court to settle the matter.
Should see what happens when they visit Mar-a-Lago.
get a full meal.
Yeah, get a shrimp cocktail.
Get to meet Kanye. It's great.
If you've been following this, you might have come across the heartbreaking story of Andre Hernandez Ramiro, a gay makeup artist who came to the U.S. legally to seek asylum, but is currently being held in that Salvadoran prison after the government decided he's Tren de Aragua. Well, we know from court filings that the government's only evidence are tattoos of crowns on his wrists, one with the word mom under it and the other with the word dad, which a random ICE officer decided were Tren de Aragua tattoos, even though Hernandez Romero repeatedly denied any affiliation with the gang. We also learned from this about the existence of the so-called Alien Enemy Validation Guide, which is a checklist that ICE agents use to assess whether someone is a TDA member, which includes whether the person's friends say they're in the gang, whether they're thought to associate with known members of the gang, and of course, whether the person has tattoos that could indicate gang membership. I think what's most alarming about the story is how hard the administration is also fighting judges who are merely asking for evidence and due process here. Nothing more at this stage. Stephen Miller posted a fucking hysterical rant over the weekend. Part of it said, quote, America voted for liberation. If every foreign trespasser gets to have their own federal trial prior to removal, then there is no liberation. There is no restoration. The invasion will be made complete. What do you guys make of all this? And why do you think it isn't a bigger story right now? Why aren't like more elected Democrats talking about this?
I would like to just quickly start with the dumb part, which is hysterical is the right way to describe that Stephen Miller tweet. The guys are such drama queens. Like, we were invaded and occupied. Entire neighborhoods were conquered. Entire towns were subjugated. Our treasury was plundered. Like, what are you talking about?
What do you mean? Where is that?
Join
a community theater troupe.
The actual specifics in the documentation, it's so paltry and so pathetic and so damning. And you look at this guy, Andre, who did truly nothing wrong. He
literally
applied for asylum at a port of entry, seized, not deported, but
legally
kidnapped.
Legally showed up at the port of entry like you're supposed to.
There's another report out of Miami of a Venezuelan who has been going to his appointments, had an appointment on February, I think, 25th. It got moved up. Gets grabbed, was showing up, was doing what you're supposed to do, applied for asylum, was and then seized because he had a tattoo. That tattoo he got with his ex-girlfriend, again a crown. Then you look at some of the documentation that ICE has used, at least in the past. The symbols are just random tattoos taken from what looks like a Google image search, including a known gang symbol being Jumpman. Jumpman being the Air Jordan symbol with the 23 above it.
Pretty popular
guy. Which means a lot of kids in my middle school were in Tren de Aragua.
Yes.
Based on their shoes and t-shirts. Yeah. They didn't have the tattoos. The Jewish mothers would never allow it. But nevertheless, yeah, where are those guys? And then you see all, I think, look, obviously this is horrible on its own. But then you see Republicans refusing, they go right to the politics. Democrats are defending gang members, which is, of course, not what's going on. They go right to these sort of Kafka-esque evasions, which is there can't be due process for invaders. Well, first of all, that's ridiculous. But also, how do you know they're fucking invaders without the due process? That's the whole point.
Victoria Spartz, who's a congresswoman from Indiana, had a couple of rowdy town halls over the weekend where people were just yelling at her the whole time. They were complaining about this and asking her about this. And she yells at one point, you violated the law, so you're not entitled to due process.
That's when due process,
no.
That's how it works.
You missed something.
Ma'am. I to your question of why aren't more Democrats talking about this, I do think in the very beginning, the stated objective by the Trump administration is like, we're going to get the worst of the worst and we're going to send them out of here, right? And so no one wanted to be seen as supporting, a Venezuelan murderer, gang member, or whatever. But clearly the implementation of the policy is anything but getting rid of the worst of the worst. And we should have, this was easy to anticipate because hardened gang members and criminals go to ground. They're hard to find. It's the people who are here legally, who brush up against the system, who let the authorities know where they are. They're the ones getting swept up. And I do think that as these individual specific cases get surfaced, there has been a lot more coverage of this. I mean, Andre's story is so shocking. A mom and a dad tattoo gets you deported. If the outcome wasn't so evil, it would almost be funny. But like, he's far from the only one. There was a guy deported because he had a tattoo of a Rolex logo. There's the Michael Jordan Jumpman logo you talked about. I love it. There was a guy with an autism awareness tattoo.
Oh, and that's so sad too, because it's like in honor of his brother.
Yeah.
And there's like videos of him like helping kids swimming and everything. It's just like...
Yeah. And this, you know, clearly ICE Googled these tattoos and put that in their lookbook. And that somehow got swept into this absolutely evil bureaucratic process where you get points for various gang affiliations. So if you had a roommate in Turin de Aragua, you could get 2 points against you for living with him, 2 for closely associating with him, 2 for being in a group photo, 2 for social media posts where you're both in the same post. And just with that, you're sent to rot in hell in a prison in El Salvador.
So what's also like, these are meant like, we're really conflating, the news is conflated too, like deporting someone versus rendering them to a foreign jail, right? Yeah. Like some of the people that I'm sure the Trump administration, for maybe they will, maybe they won't, they don't have told us fucking anything. Some of these people were already in detention, right? For crimes, what have you. Those people were sent to a jail. But some of these people showed up for appointments. They were not in prison. They were free. They were living, they were doing their jobs. They were showing up for their appointments. They are going, they are free. They're not being deported. Like Andre told his family that he thought he was going to be deported. This guy in Miami thought he was going to be deported, right? Next thing they know, they're not sent back to Venezuela. They're sent to a prison. They have no sentence. They've not been charged with anything. I mean, there may be some, there may be some charges coming related to undocumented immigration.
We have no idea.
But we have no idea. But as of right now, these people haven't been certainly publicly charged with any crime, convicted any crime that would warrant them being in prison in the United States, let alone being sent to a gulag in El Salvador without any time frame. Like, how long is this person meant to be there?
And the rationale in the first place for the El Salvador prison and for Gitmo, again, for some of these deportees, is that you can't send them back to some countries, their own country, some of them, because they're not accepting flights, deportation flights. So for a while, Venezuela was saying, like, no, you can't send people back here.
Mm-hmm.
And so then basically the Trump administration justification is, okay, so if you have this dangerous terrorist, a criminal gang member who has a bad criminal background, has murdered people, whatever, and we are overcrowded in our detention centers here, then we're going to use Guantanamo and we're going to have this deal with El Salvador to do that, which is like, maybe for the worst of the worst, you can like make an argument for it. But now when you are just like, there's people have are picked up with no due process and don't have a background and they're making mistakes all their own, now we're just shipping them to a fucking prison?
They're free the day before.
In another country?
The other part of this too is, things are bad enough, and it's, I think, sometimes not valuable to like to live in even worse hypotheticals. But I do think it's worth noting that they are calling Tariff Day Liberation Day. They're referring to going after immigrants as a kind of liberation. They're putting these things together. Right now, we don't know what their plans are, but I don't believe, obviously, the Trump administration is not planning to ramp down deportations. They want to ramp this up. Does anyone believe that the number of errors or mistakes, if we're going to not even, they seem quite purposeful at times, are going to go down as they do this more? Does anyone think that legal permanent residents aren't going to get swept up in this? Does anyone think citizens aren't going to get swept up in this? Like, that is what's coming. That's what they want. They want, Trump likes a circus. He likes the circus of these deportations. When this ramps up and they do it on a broader scale, there's going to be a circus too. They're going to look for the worst of the worst to make them the face of it. Then there's going to be all these harrowing stories and all these examples. And like, that's what we're heading towards. And so if we're not fighting for the due process of people like Andres, of people like these Venezuelans who applied for asylum, did what we told them to do, then watch as this happens and gets closer and closer to affecting more and more legal permanent residents, citizens, more and more people.
The one silver lining is that you're seeing some like really fringy, even far right conservatives say, this is crazy, we shouldn't be doing this. But the thing that really worries me is that, so you've got Rubio and Bukele, Nayib Bukele, the president of El Salvador, saying that these individuals sent down to El Salvador are going to get a 1-year sentence and it's renewable. On what legal authority are they being held? How long are they going to be locked in prison for being accused of a crime? And even more scary to me, let's say a judge says, this is effed up, you got to get him back, Trump administration. Bukele is just going to say no. Like, F you to the judiciary, like, come invade my country. And Stephen Miller and Rubio and all the gang in the administration are going to cackle and love it.
Yeah, I was going to say, he could say no, because Rubio was like, yeah, you can say no if you want. I don't care.
Yeah, I don't want the problem.
Supreme Court can't touch you.
Well, we've already seen that, right? Yeah. He's the Secretary of State for the United States. A judge ruled that these flights had to be turned around. The president of El Salvador says, ha ha, too late. And Rubio doesn't say, excuse me, how dare you on behalf of the United States. He reposts it. He loves it.
Yep.
I do want to talk about the Democrats issue just before we move on, because I ask Ruben Gallego about this. You'll hear in the interview. And it was a bit of a frustrating exchange, I would say. Like, on one hand, Gallego, so he started off by basically saying, like, no, we shouldn't fight. I was like, why aren't more Democrats talking about this? And he's like, well, we shouldn't walk into the trap he set for us. And he was like, we should talk about, the people who were getting deported without due process and all this kind of stuff. I'm like, well, that's what I'm saying. And right. I was like, I actually haven't heard a bunch of Democrats just condemn deportations just writ large, right? Like, people are making these specific stories, and I feel like we should. He's like, yeah, it's just that they want us to do. And so it's like a political sort of, Democrats are going to get stuck in a trap on immigration for arguing. And I understand where he's coming from. And like I said to him, like, I've been critical of Democrats on immigration as well. But if we go back to the first term, when he was separating children from their families, there was a huge outcry, so big that he had to reverse course on that, mostly, right? And he had to stop it. And like, I just think that if you're a Democratic politician right now, you just have to have the confidence to know that you can make a case that, yes, you can deport criminals and gang members, but don't deport or don't rendition someone without due process to a foreign prison. I feel like that's an easy case to make.
Also, okay, let's say it is a trap. Let's say it's bad politics. The U.S. government is kidnapping people. That guy, he doesn't know that there's people fighting for his freedom right now. He doesn't know that. He thought he was being deported. Next thing you know, he's on this flight to El Salvador. He's in a waking nightmare. He's been there for, what, 2 weeks? Hadn't spoke to a soul?
Many of them. We have how many stories?
Well, most people in that prison, their families haven't heard from them in years.
It's not his country, right? I'm sure they're all Latinos are the same to them. It's not his country. He's in a foreign country. He has no idea how long it will last. Who knows what he's being told? This man's being tortured. This is torture.
So if the politics,
I think the politics are good. I think like due process is something that everyone should care about and want. And
we should make it something people care about.
That's why I want more. I want more Democrats out there just like yelling about this, because.
Tariffs, people came to learn. People learn through these debates. They really do. Maybe not as well as they used to. Maybe it's all fucked up by a lot of noise and misinformation. But if we don't have the debate, we will lose on due process and watch as this gets worse and worse.
Before we go, we want to talk about some important elections taking place on Tuesday. Maybe as you're listening to this, in Florida, there are two special elections for the House seats vacated by Matt Gaetz and Signal enthusiast Mike Waltz. Gaetz's seat is widely seen as being safely Republican, but the race for Waltz's seat, which he won by 33 points just in November, is making Republicans quite nervous. A poll from last week showed Republican State Senator Randy Fine ahead of Democrat Josh Wheel by only 4 points. Again, this is in a district that Waltz won just 4 months ago by 33 points. The other election, a swing seat on Wisconsin's Supreme Court, which we've talked about a lot before, has turned into the most expensive judicial race in U.S. history. Over $90 million has been spent. $20 million by Elon Musk alone, who held a town hall in Green Bay Sunday night, where he gave away two legally questionable million-dollar checks to voters who signed a petition against, quote, activist judges. Here's what else Elon had to say.
I feel like this is one of those things that may not seem that it's going to affect the entire destiny of humanity, but I think it will. I mean, it was inevitable that at least a few Soros operatives would be in the audience. Give my regards to George. Say hi to George for me.
the richest man in the world demagoguing George Soros. I'm sorry, buddy. It just doesn't work.
As he goes to pay people for
$1 million
votes.
George Soros is a great man. He's a great man. A
couple of operatives right here.
Also, he's so hyperbolic. It doesn't matter if it's the space race or a Wisconsin judicial race. The future of humanity is always at stake. Yeah. Like, come on,
big
buddy.
Big race in Wisconsin. We've
it's
been saying
very
that.
Important. Yeah. I don't know if it's civilization.
A little much there. I don't know if it's civilization.
This is not the most important point about this, but like the idea that like anyone who's opposed to him is a Soros operative. Everyone who's against him is evil. This race is civilizational. Everything has become like Manichaean, this sort of good versus evil struggle.
It's almost like he's taken on the personality of the social media app he bought.
Well, yes. And he's taking on the politics of someone who just found out about politics. He's talking about it like a 13-year-old who's doing their first like debate tournament. And he goes on these tirades about like liberals don't under they're only doing this because they want undocumented people to get Social Security and also vote. It's all just like this bullshit. And then he's confused why people aren't like he acts as though there's no legitimate criticism that could possibly exist of what he's doing, dismissing half the country, and then wonders why he's not more beloved and why these protests are all popping up. I found it very frustrating.
By Monday, he's offering $20 to literally anyone willing to get a Wisconsin resident to hold up a picture of Brad Schimmel, who's the Republican candidate for the court, and the thumbs up sign. The Wisconsin Attorney General, Josh Call, tried to get the Wisconsin Supreme Court to shut down the $1 million checks, but they declined to take the case. And, you know, I guess last minute, Musk tried to make the whole contest less legally questionable, maybe, he originally said the $1 million checks would go to people who, in appreciation for taking the time to vote, but you're not supposed to do that because you're not supposed to induce anyone or reward mm-hmm. anyone for voting. So he
can't buy votes. Pretty bedrock principle.
He reframed it, the giveaway, to focus on the petition. and so that's that. But I don't know. It still seems a little shady.
Yeah. I think Elon Musk has now made himself the main character of this race, and I think like a lot of people assume, oh, that must backfire, right? Because everybody, I mean, Elon Musk is not a popular figure, and I want that to be true. I think there's a little bit of method to the madness, which is Republicans are doing the math and saying in this lower turnout off-cycle election, if they get 60% of their Trump vote, they can win. Mm. And they're banking on the fact that the hardcore Democrats are already pretty well motivated, which they are. I was there. They're motivated. That's exciting. That's great. They know that we have this sort of midterm advantage, this hyper-engaged advantage. And so they're assuming that Elon Musk, as much as it does damage for him to be in Wisconsin to them, which I think it does, that they need him there to make this a Trump referendum, because that's their only hope of getting enough of the Trump people out. And when you look at what the Republicans were putting on doors in Wisconsin, it like the Democratic flyers, the pro-Crawford flyers are Crawford and Schimmel and their two sets of positions. Mm. The Republican flyer is just a big old picture of Trump. Mm. And it just said that Trump is winning for America and radical judges are trying to stop him.
Yeah. They need the Trump voters out. They usually only vote in presidentials.
Base versus base turnout election. Maybe Elon going there will help motivate some significant number of people to turn out who wouldn't otherwise have known about the election and voted. So we'll see. I do think Elon, he claims the spending is about free speech. It's a disgusting perversion of democracy. So I don't know. Like Ben Wickler was saying, he might have spent up to $26 million at this point. He has made himself the face of this campaign. If they win, that sucks, and I'll be very sad. And if they lose, we need to tie it around Elon Musk's neck, make this an argument that there's a political cost to everything he does of being associated with him, of even his money, because that's a pretty significant check on his political strength early on.
I think that's right.
You see, one of the $1 million checks went to the chairman of the Wisconsin College Republicans.
Nice.
So just grab
it. He was a Turning Points USA ballot chase representative in 2024.
Well, everybody's talked about the illegality around buying votes, but in the run-up to the election in November, there were questions about whether this was a true random drawing, and it's clear that it wasn't. Like this is why, you know, the joke is like, oh, liberals sign up. Like, no, they're not choosing at random. You can't win. They're going through and finding ideal candidates to give this money to, which again feels completely ridiculous. Like the image of a billionaire who is also one of the most powerful figures in the government flying in on a private jet to throw shekels down in front of people to come crawl and grab them to get votes for people is so fundamentally un-American. It's so disgusting to see this guy who's basically now acting as like the grand vizier to the Sultan. And, you know, if you have a friend in Wisconsin, text him. If you like, you can go to votesofamerica.com/Wisconsin. They still need some cash. They still need people to make calls. But I do think right now, the most important thing, if you're in Wisconsin, if you're near Wisconsin, text friends, text people in that state. We got to get every last vote out because it will be a lower turnout election. And it's just, this has to be stopped.
Yeah. What do you guys, I mean, while we still don't know the results of any of these races, what do you think they will say about how people are feeling about Trump 2.0 and Republicans? If do you think like, what are your expectations?
Oh, I'm like so afraid. So we went through this cycle and Judge Janet Protasiewicz beat the Republican.
She's crushing that name now.
I'm a Protasiewicz. It takes a Protasiewicz to say Protasiewicz. But I think what's interesting, right, is like we're already seeing the impact. Like Elise Stefanik is not going to be ambassador to the UN because even in her deep red district, they're not sure they can hold it. Right.
That makes me so happy.
It makes me so sure to get her farewell tour.
She had so many meetings.
It's awesome.
With so many boring briefings about the UN.
She gave up her leadership job. She gave up her leadership. That job has been filled. It's awesome.
She went to apartment. I guess they have an apartment for you, but she went shopping for furniture in New York. Nope.
I will say if we lose Wisconsin, I think it will rightly be quite bad for us.
Oh, no, absolutely.
This is all politics. Substantively, very bad, obviously, right? But not like we should win this, but, you know, and if the margin is like the same as 2024, then it's going to be like the general election in 2024, then it's just fucking frustrating, you know? But if everything that's happened over the last couple months and then we get that result in Wisconsin.
I think it'd be pretty devastating, yeah. It also just would tell us about the Trump base and their willingness to do what they're told, right?
Yeah.
And to show up, which would be make them more formidable than we thought.
And I will say, if we win, and we win by, you know, a couple points here and there, like Elon Musk going there and then dumping $26 million and then coming up short is
the best.
Then we should feel pretty good, you know? And then I'll be looking at the margin in that Florida race too to see if, you know, if a 33-point
that's a huge
district
one.
And he only loses by like 4 or 5. That's fucking
I think the combination. Yeah.
That should be a huge siren for all Republicans going into the midterms. Also, just bigger picture, $81 million have been spent on a Wisconsin Supreme Court race. That is disgusting. Like Citizens United was such a disaster. Our campaign finance system is such a disaster. Like, I don't know how we can fix it at this point with this Congress, with these courts, with these judges, but like, this is just a terrible way to run a railroad.
I will say too that the timing of these races, the week that they are going to be debating this tax bill in Congress.
Yeah, no,
like, so if it is bad for Republicans and, you know, Randy Fine barely squeaks it out or whatever, you're going to see like the Mike Lawlers and some of these Republicans in swing districts in the House. They're going to be thinking twice about how many how much in Medicaid cuts you want, what to do about the tax hikes, what to do about some other budget cuts. Like they're going to be thinking about that.
Absolutely. Look, I mean, yeah, if in the same week they learn that Republicans have lost like 10, 15 or more points in the generic ballot, and they learn that Elon Musk's money can't protect them if they vote for Medicaid cuts, tax cuts for the rich, that's pretty damning.
All right. When we come back from the break, you'll hear my interview with Senator Ruben Gallego. But first, one big announcement. For the month of April, we're offering a 30-day free trial if you want to subscribe to our Friends of the Pod community. As you hear us say all the time, joining Friends of the Pod is the best way to support our work here at Crooked Media. And we just made the experience even better. You can now enjoy offline and Love It or Leave It ad-free, in addition to the ad-free versions of Pod Save America and Pod Save the World.
Wow.
We're not going to let Tommy have all the ad-free fun, you know?
Yeah, you still got to record them, guys. Bad news for you.
You'll also get exclusive content like Polar Coaster with Dan, and you'll get access to our amazing Discord community where you can process the news with other people who feel as crazy as you do when you read the news. Sign up today at crooked.com/friends or through Apple Podcasts to start your 30-day free trial. When we come back, Ruben Gallego. Pod Save America is brought to you by Helix. We love Helix mattresses. I got a couple in my house. Charlie's got one.
Very comfortable.
I know you have a guest Helix mattress.
Yeah, our guest room's got a Helix mattress. Everybody raves about it.
So how will you know which Helix mattress works for you and your body? Take the Helix sleep quiz and find your perfect mattress in under 2 minutes. The Helix lineup offers 20 unique mattresses, including the award-winning Lux and Ultra Premium Elite Collections. Helix Plus, a mattress designed for big and tall sleepers. Helix Kids, a mattress designed for growing bodies, endorsed by child sleep experts. Helix knows there's no better way to test out a new mattress than by sleeping on it in your own home. That's why they offer a 100-night trial and a 10 to 15-year warranty to try out your new Helix mattress. Plus, your personalized mattress is shipped straight to your door free of charge. Go to helixsleep.com/crooked for 20% off site-wide. That's helixsleep.com/crooked for 20% off site-wide. helixsleep.com/crooked.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place, so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month, so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Ruben Gallego, welcome back to the show. First time on since I've been able to call you senator.
It feels good.
Considering how Trump's second term is unfolding so far, would you say your win was more of a blessing or a curse?
Look, it's always a blessing, man. Like that. Yeah, you know, it's a hard situation, but I get to say that I'm a U.S. senator. And if you kind of look at where I started in life, all things aside, and I should never even ended up, you know, being in Congress. And the fact I get to be the first Latino U.S. senator from Arizona is pretty cool.
How does what we've seen from Trump in the last few months match up with your expectations for what a second term would bring? Are you more alarmed, less alarmed, or is it about what you expected?
I'm more alarmed. Look, I kind of saw some of the like autocratic bullshit that he's doing ahead of time, but not at the level that he's doing it now. I kind of foresaw some of the stuff when it comes to the government cuts, firing of these workers, but not the way they're doing it right now. And then some of the stuff, I'm just like, what the hell is going on here? Like the cuts to federal, to the VA, cuts to firing all these veterans. Like this is the kind of stuff that like makes no logical sense. Makes no political sense, just tells me, like, you know, he might be out to lunch when it comes to a lot of this stuff.
I mean, what's most alarmed me in the last month has been what they're doing on immigration. And, like, you know, I'm good with deporting criminals. I get that any president has quite a bit of power over immigration and deportations, even if I don't agree with the policy. But they are grabbing students off the streets, detaining legal residents, jailing people in this foreign prison in El Salvador with no due process, no trial, in some cases based on, you know, guessing what tattoos might mean. And then when a judge asks for evidence, they are threatening him with impeachment. Mike Johnson's talking about eliminating district courts. And I guess I'm just wondering, like, why more Democrats aren't hair on fire about this?
Well, because most Americans are actually agree with what the president's doing on immigration. And it's just like, you know, that's actually one area where he's still polling well. He's still like at 54 to 55%. And one of the things that, you know, we have to focus on are, and I talk about this all the time, it's like when we fight on the grounds of immigration, let's fight smartly, right? So we should talk about the fact that, you know, we have, for example, a stylist who has no contact with criminal world that was deported because without due process, right? That's a really good example. But to overall argue that like we shouldn't be deporting criminals to El Salvador, I think it's a very dumb argument that will politically, it's not going to win. Because if you talk to a lot of people and you tell them like, hey, should we be deporting these hardcore criminals to another country since we can't, you know, hold them in jail here anymore? A lot of people are going to say, absolutely. Now, if you add, can we do that without due process? That's when people understand like, no, obviously we need to have due process. Due process is important, obviously, not just for immigrants, also important for United States citizens, because you will see, unfortunately from my experiences, you will see U.S. citizens get wrapped up in this kind of stuff without due process. So we have to be very smart about how we fight when it comes to issues of immigration and border security. I think a lot of what we want to do will sound very good among on a little circle and bubble. But when you get out and talk to real America, including Latinos, they're going to agree a lot with what Donald Trump is doing. And we have to figure out a way to kind of get in there with a precision strike of a good argument that kind of keeps our morals together, but also allows us to have, you know, some type of ability to bring these voters back to us.
So I get that. And I was one person who, after the election, has been fairly critical of Democrats' position on immigration and letting people know, by the way, most people in this country want people to come here legally. They don't want people to come here illegally. They are, you know, more likely to be in favor of deportations than not. It just, this to me feels like something so much different than
It's designed to be different. It's designed to be different. It's designed for you to get into this fight with him instead of focusing on the fact that he's deporting mothers and children, the fact that he is, you know, causing, you know, some of them, a lot of, you know, foreign students that usually are great contributors to our economy to be missing. He wants you to fight him on this. There's a reason why this is all happening right now. He wants us to be talking about, these majority of them Venezuelan gang members that got sent over there. And he wants us to get into this nitty gritty. So we have to have have arguments in public about due process, knowing that the American public understands almost zero of it, right? Don't get into the trap. This is like, you know, if you see an ambush coming, you have no responsibility to actually walk into that ambush, right? And this is just my personal advice to Democrats. Fight your fight. Talk about Dreamers. Talk about the fact that there's this Colombian couple that's been here for 30 years that was recently deported who had no criminal history whatsoever. Talk about, you know, green card holders. But don't jump into the fight where they want you to fight. They're doing this on purpose. They're doing this on purpose.
But do you think I've been pleasantly surprised. I have not seen a lot of Democrats in the last couple of weeks sort of just be fighting the deportations in general. I actually think that the people who have raised alarms have been over these specific cases where people just aren't getting any due process. And I guess one of the things I worry about, and I do think this would be appealing to a much broader part of the electorate, is now it's, you know, Venezuelans that they think are gang members and a foreign student who they say, you know, was participating in pro-Hamas protests. But like, if there's no due process, where does it end? How do we even know someone's a non-citizen that they're rounding up?
How do you know that it's citizens that aren't being rounded up and taken away without, well, they shouldn't be taken away because any citizen needs to stay in the United States. You focus on the actual case. Don't get involved in this bigger fight that is very popular. I'm telling you right now, if you get into this fight over should we be sending people to El Salvador or not, you're giving him the ground that he wants. Fight for the individual cases. Fight for the actual, you know, stylist that we're talking about. But if you try to get into this bigger argument, you're losing. And that's where they want you to be. They want you to be on that losing ground, because then we have to explain due process. We have to explain why it's different for these, gang members versus non-gang members. Like, it's just not smart. We need to figure out how to fight so we could win, so we could stop this shit.
Yeah. We're talking at the beginning of a week where Republicans in Congress will be figuring out how to pay for the massive tax cut that Trump wants. A senior White House official told Axios that they're actually discussing getting rid of the tax cuts for the top 1% because, quote, if we renew tax cuts for the rich paid for by throwing people off Medicaid, we're going to get fucking slaughtered. Do you think your Republican colleagues would ever give up on tax cuts for the rich and Medicaid cuts?
I mean, they're more likely to cut Medicaid cuts than they are to, you know, give up on tax cuts to the rich. I mean, that's their bread and butter. That's, you know, the whole reason of living for the Republican Party. But politically speaking, I mean, I was out in rural Arizona. I mean, this is the part of the state where you have to drive hours and hours in order to get to some cities, and they're not big cities. And in rural Arizona, people are worried because rural Arizona, 30% of rural Arizona is on Medicaid. So when you shut down or start throwing people off Medicaid, it's going to end up having huge impacts. Hospitals shut down, everything else like that. And people will know that the only reason they're doing this is to give tax cuts to the rich. So what I think they're going to try to do is they're going to end up doing a couple things. Number one, they're going to try to shave Medicaid, see if they can politically get away with it by coming up with bullshit reasons why people should not be on Medicaid. Number two, they're going to try to change the law, the rule, as we call it here in the Senate, and saying like, well, we don't actually have to justify these cuts. We actually don't have to find any further cuts. They're already existing in law. So who cares? Just keep expanding them, right? And that way they don't actually have to go and find somewhere else to cut. And then the rich get their tax cuts. At the end of the day, we still end up getting screwed if you're working class, because they're going to end up borrowing a ton of money. It's going to keep inflation higher. It's going to keep interest rates higher. And, you know, it's not going to, I think it's probably going to slow down the economy even more. So, you know, working class America is going to end up paying one way or the other for this, the tax cuts for the rich.
I'm not going to relitigate the politics of the shutdown fight, but one takeaway seemed to be that Democrats in Congress need to do a better job of communicating their strategy. Obviously, you guys don't have the votes to stop this tax bill from becoming law, but what are you thinking in terms of the strategy around this fight?
Well, I mean, the strategy around the fight is we have to show why they're doing this. Now, you talked about this, right? The only reason they want to do this is because they want to give their rich buddies, Elon Musk, more money. And the only way they're going to do that is they're going to gut the working class at some point. We need to, you know, trying to give an oppositional view in a contradiction to that, something that actually people can, you know, talk about. You know, I think the Democrats should be talking about, you know, trying to bring a child tax credit instead of giving tax cuts to the rich. I think Democrats should be talking about a minimum wage that actually people can live on instead of giving tax cut to the rich. This is the thing that we need to kind of be giving a viewpoint of what you can get is an alternative. So just being a party of no is not going to work. And just saying, hey, we're the party that's going to stand up for working class people, we don't actually introduce any real legislation to actually make people feel that that's the case, is not going to be a winning message. And you know, I think the my lesson from the CR shutdown was a lot of lessons, but a lot of my colleagues felt uncomfortable because they weren't they felt that there was no messaging that could give them higher ground against the bully pulpit of Donald Trump. My argument to them, like, well, yeah, you guys, we got ourselves in a situation because we never actually had an affirmative oppositional view that people could actually, you know, jump on it and grab a hold. And I think that's what we need to really do when we get into reconciliation coming up.
It's interesting you say that, because I've talked to some of your colleagues, particularly your younger, newer colleagues, who also seem a little frustrated that there's not been enough conversation about a sort of an alternative vision and agenda from the Democratic Party. Is there resistance to that from leadership, or
not anymore?
Why haven't? That's good.
I think a lot of us showed our frustration and were very clear what direction the party was heading, unless we were listened to, and I think that's they're listening now.
What do you, in terms of that alternate sort of vision, agenda, I know you mentioned the child tax cut, but what does it sound like to you? Like, we haven't had a lot of debate about what sort of that forward-looking vision in the party might sound like. You know, I just sat down with Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson.
I know, I'm just going to be repeating their shit. I haven't read the book yet, so I can't plagiarize. I think it's very simple. Number one, the problem that we have is we have a lack of energy, right? And we need to make sure that when we take power, we use power. What does that look like? You know, like, you know, actually fundamentally changing people's lives for the better. You know, and, you know, right away I would do a good minimum wage increase, you know, $15, $17, whatever it is, peg it to inflation automatically, so it keeps growing every year. Child tax credit, as I said, $200-$300 per family. You know, everyone that's making less than, let's say, $100,000, $120,000 a year for childcare. I mean, right now it's more expensive for you to send your kid to childcare than it is to pay for tuition, in-state tuition for most universities. Let's just give direct childcare subsidies to families to take care of that, to take care of their kids. Like, these are the kind of impactful things we should be doing right away. I think we should do a credit buster. There's so many people right now that are paying off credit card debt that they were living off of inflation. During inflation, they basically survived by putting on credit card debt. Now they're carrying the highest amount of credit card debt in the history of this country. We should help, you know, these families at least pay off a good chunk of their credit card debt. Now that could just be a direct subsidy to them, but that would be a huge relief. Like, that, we need to get Americans to understand when you elect Democrats, good shit happens and I feel better, right? It's that simple. And a lot of times we get into these very kind of like wonky bureaucratic process that we think we'll end up getting credit for, and we never, ever, ever do. And, you know, that's the one time I, you know, I can tell you, like, my family, working class family, remembers, especially not my direct family, but my sisters and my cousins, they finally remember when they were all getting the child tax credit. And that's what they remember at Democrats as being good, right? So, yeah. You know, having a real focus on, you know, an energetic response really to the needs of working class America would be huge. Something that every time there's an election, like, Democrats got me this, right? That's it.
What lessons do you take from the Biden administration, which obviously passed quite a bit of significant legislation around infrastructure, climate, and then didn't really get much credit for any of it, even if you put the worries about cost of living aside, which was hard to put aside, but not a lot of people sort of felt in their lives any impact from the Biden administration's legislation.
Like, I hate to be the Cassandra here, but I was telling this to people in the administration from day one, that they're too focused on, first of all, infrastructure. Like, every president runs on infrastructure. Do they pass it? Do they not? But no one ever gets credit for it. You know, if you look at even the unions that benefited from infrastructure ended up voting for Trump. I think we have to understand that unless people feel it, then it's not real, right? You can talk all you want about, you know, the quick chargers for electric vehicles that run across the whole country, but unless somehow someone sees it and how it affects them, they're not going to fit. You could talk about the IRA and all this kind of stuff, but until you actually see the results, it's not going to impact you. One of the things that was really messed up by the IRA, people forget, is that a lot of the stuff that really, really, really had impact, for example, the negotiations for Medicare prescriptions, drugs. The other one was, for example, like bringing down the overall cost of what people have to pay for if you're a senior on Medicare to $2,000 a year capped. None of that started till 2026. It was whenever they were negotiating a lot, the stuff that would be actually impactful to people, I think purposely it was put off so it would actually not have any real impact on people's life till after the election. And, you know, when the Biden and his administration were negotiating this, I think they were just happy to take the victory and walk away. And they should have realized that it was the whole thing was one big setup, because we ended up creating a $1 trillion bill that no one really felt the effects of right away. And, you know, I think that probably cost us a lot of the election right there.
I don't know if you saw over the weekend, Gavin Newsom was on Bill Maher's show and said that the Democratic Party's brand is, quote, toxic. And then Ro Khanna responded and said it's not toxic and we shouldn't be sort of joining in the chorus of people attacking the Democrats. We should be unified against Trump. Where do you come down on that?
I don't want to get involved in this little California civil war. most people don't really care about parties. Like this whole it's toxic versus not toxic. Like that's like a bunch of like political scientists, pundits, and they're all talking. If you want to change the opinion that people have for the Democratic Party, we need to start winning. That's it, right? The reason we're right now, quote unquote, it's toxic is because we lost, right? And once we start having some wins, we start having some people actually, you know, I think showing, you know, what the Democratic Party is in a, you know, real personal way for people running for office, the presidential candidates are coming up, everything else like that, then, you know, I think we'll get our mojo back. But some of the stuff that we're doing right now is just kind of, you know, it's like public therapy, I guess, when we should really just be focusing. And I'm all for therapy, don't get me wrong. But I really think we should be focusing on just like trying to figure out how to like immediately bring wins. So from my experience in Arizona, you know, in Arizona, it's always been a swing state. What happened in Arizona for many years when we started winning, you know, elections, Democrats, is because we started in a momentum of just winning. And eventually the message in Arizona, especially among voters, was like, oh, damn, these Democrats, they know how to win in Arizona. So there was always this excitement. And, you know, right now we just don't have that. We need a couple wins under our belts. We need to make sure that we're really showing who we're fighting for. And I think that's where we get our momentum back. But like these kind of like sniping that, you know, politicians do to each other, it's cute, but it doesn't really make a big difference, I think.
So one story I wanted to bring up. I've lost track of how many stories keep popping up about the wildly corrupt relationship between the Trump family and the crypto industry.
Yeah.
Just today I saw that Don Jr. and Eric are starting a Bitcoin mining adventure. So congrats to them.
Yeah.
I've always been a bit of a crypto skeptic since the industry is largely unregulated and seemingly rife with corruption. I know you're one of the more pro-crypto Democrats in Congress and are the ranking member of the Digital Assets Subcommittee. Why should I not be skeptical of crypto if it is better regulated than it is now?
Yeah, I was going to say, like, if it's not regulated, you should be skeptical of it. The fact is, you know, crypto is here to stay no matter what, right? It's either going to be a U.S.-based, economy, or it's going to be overseas. If we could bring it here, base it here, and regulate it to American standards, it's going to be a fine asset, right? If we don't do that, it will be a bunch of rug pulls. It will be a bunch of, pump and dump, whether it's stocks, meme coins, whatever it is. That's actually what's going to happen. I think if we could bring this here, have it regulated under our U.S. systems where you could get prosecuted, you had to have transparency, you had to have, consumer protection, I think that's the better way to go. Are we there yet? No. This is what Congress is really working on to make sure we get to that point. But it is better than what is going to exist right now. Because right now it is, it runs the gamut. It can be, legitimate, Bitcoins down to, meme coins that are being like hawked by anybody just to kind of do a quick sale and get out. So I would rather have it regulated under U.S. systems than not. But right now, it's really not, and it's only going to get worse if we don't bring it into, I think, U.S. compliance.
So, last question. Last time Democrats were completely shut out of power in D.C., which was after the 2004 election, one of the party's only new senators went on to become a history-making president after just a few years in office. How are you thinking about your role in the Democratic Party right now and your future?
Oh, well, I mean, like for me, I feel like my role right now is to kind of bring some hard truths to the party, right? And look, I won a very hard race. Latinos started moving away from the party. Latino males started moving into the party. And what I saw in past campaigns is that, a lot of times people just kind of want to whistle past the graveyard. And I want to make sure the Democrats have a fighting chance. Our only fighting chance is two. Number one, we need to bring Latinos back into our fold. And as the numbers we said before, and we have to have a fighting chance with men, right? Not that we're going to win it, but we have to do better and stop sliding away. I think like my role right now is to be that person that is unafraid and willing to have conversations with fellow Democrats and be honest about, do we want to win or do we want to feel good? Because sometimes they don't align. And for me, I want to win to make sure that we could protect, our families, our most vulnerable communities, our standing in the world. And sometimes that means we're going to have to piss off people within our tent, not on purpose, but in order for us to win. And I think we have to, my job right now is to kind of have those conversations. And if anybody that wants to run for president wants to talk to me about that, I'm gladly sit down. I'll talk to you from my perspective. I'm here. I'm a good Democrat. I want to make sure Democrats win in 4 years. And that's going to be my focus.
I know it's early, but how are those conversations going so far? Are you feeling more hopeful or are you feeling more frustrated?
Well, no one's talked to me yet.
not just about president, but just the conversations you're having with people about what's wrong with the Democratic Party and where we need to go.
I mean, this is it's kind of a loaded question. For those that want to see a path forward, they're keeping their minds open and come in and talk to me. I think I have ruffled some feathers, to be honest. I know I did something wrong or right, or I did something right because sometimes when I do something, I'll get it both from the left and the right. On Twitter and social media. I think there's some people, from a more liberal bent that are mad at me. And again, like I do this all with love. Like I want us to win. I want Democrats to be competitive. And some of that we have to have a very realistic view of what the world looks like and what these voters want. And, sometimes it doesn't align. Our primary voter is very different from our general election voter. And it's very easy for us to make our primary voter happy and then lose the general election. I just don't want to see us doing that again. And this is why, and because it has consequences. Look what happens when we lose. And I think it's not going to get any better. You know, the next Republican that wins will do just exactly what Donald Trump is doing. And so we have to win elections from here on out. And that means that, you know, if I have to guide some of my friends in a way that makes sure we win general elections, I'm going to do it. And that may tick off some people, but we have to win. You know, we don't win. Not winning has really bad consequences on this country, as we can tell.
Sure does. Winning is much better.
Yes.
Ruben Gallego, thank you, as
Gracias,
always, for
buddy.
Joining Pod Save America. And come visit us next time you're in L.A.
I will. Adios.
That's our show for today. Thanks to Ruben Gallego for coming on. Dan and I are both off later this week, but fear not. Tommy's going to have a new show for you on Friday.
What?
Oh, sorry. This is okay. The way we tell you about those things.
I mean, Jesus, you sit in an office with somebody, they tell you.
Thanks, everyone. If you want to listen to Pod Save America ad-free or get access to our subscriber Discord and exclusive podcasts, consider joining our Friends of the Pod community at crooked.com/friends or subscribe on Apple Podcasts directly from the Pod Save America feed. Also, be sure to follow Pod Save America on TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube for full episodes, bonus content, and more. And before you hit that next button, you can help boost this episode by leaving us a review and by sharing it with friends and family. Pod Save America is a Crooked Media production. Our producers are David Toledo and Saul Rubin. Our associate producer is Farah Safari. Reed Cherlin is our executive editor, and Adrian Hill is our executive producer. The show is mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Jordan Cantor is our sound engineer, with audio support from Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Madeline Herringer is our head of news and programming. Matt DeGroat is our head of production. Naomi Sengel is our executive assistant. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Haley Jones, Ben Heathcoat, Mia Kelman, Molly Lobel, Kirill Pelaviv, and David Tolles. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.
If you guys like Pod Save America, please consider subscribing to our Friends of the Pod program. So Friends of the Pod get lots of stuff. You get more Pod Save America. That includes our new show, which is called Pod Save America Only Friends.
It's where Dan gets naked.
Where Dan gets full frontal nudity, but mostly it's a bi-weekly subscription-exclusive podcast that is basically Pod Save America, but behind a paywall. So it's a little bit looser and more fun. And it's Lovett and Favreau and me and Pfeiffer and then other Crooked hosts. We go deeper on the news and cover more stories. You also get Open Tabs, which is a weekly behind-the-scenes newsletter from the show. Plus, you get ad-free episodes of your favorite Crooked podcasts and all kinds of other stuff. Dan will come to your house and clean it once every quarter.
Yeah, clothed.
Dan is very busy, clothed only. But along with just getting great content, becoming a friend of the pod, joining our subscription community, is the number one thing you can do to help us grow, to help independent progressive media. So if you've ever thought about doing it, if you ever wanted more Pod Save America, consider going to crooked.com/friends and becoming a friend of the pod.